This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Regressing to the mean since 2015, it's the Hockey Pediocast with your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey Pediocast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy and my Elite Prospects ringside colleague, Jack Fraser. Jack, what's going on, man?
How are you doing?
I'm good. We're recording this on a Saturday morning. Round two is going to be starting tonight, so that's exciting. And we're going to use this as an opportunity to combine a round one sort of recap to help preview round two, and hopefully people will listen to it in a timely fashion. I know that putting out content over the weekend isn't typically ideal, and if anyone's waiting and saving it for Monday morning, three of the series will already have started, but we're just going to have to make do, and hopefully we won't wind up sounding horribly wrong after all the game ones. But so I'm excited. We're going to get right into this here. Let's start with Tampa Bay versus Carolina. And I really want to start with the good stuff and what should be a banger of a series. I'm not sure if this is a series I'm more excited about than Vegas, Colorado, but I think it has the opportunity to be a remarkable theater, and just watching the pace that these two teams are going to play at. So what's the number one storyline for you in this one, whether it's something we saw in round one from these two teams in their respective series, or sort of how they match up, or whatever fascinates you the most about these two?
Yeah, I'm really excited to see the top two lines, I think, go head to head, because I just finished writing my breakdown of this series for EP Ringside and kind of digging into more of the micro stats aspects of how these teams match up. It really kind of struck me how similar they are in a lot of ways in terms of how they play the game, especially at 5-on-5 offensively. Like, these are two very kind of in-zone offense focused teams, especially when you get to those kind of bottom nine players in the forward group. Like, you're talking a lot of point shots, a lot of forechecking, a lot of dump and chase, especially for the Hurricanes. But then everything kind of breaks down when you get to those top lines, whether it's the Kucherov and Point Palat line for Tampa Bay, or obviously Carolina's as well, where suddenly you start to see a lot more rush chances, a lot more dynamic looking offense. And you know, I think especially if you're talking about a matchup where Tampa's playing against Carolina, who are such a cycle heavy team, those counterattacks can be really deadly. And I'm excited and interested to see whether that offensive structure of the Hurricanes might break down in some places if they're pushed by, you know, Kucherov and Point coming the other way.
And I think we're going to see a lot of that. I think we're going to see a lot of Kucherov, Point, and Palat versus Aho, Svechnikov, and Teravainen, or whatever they wind up doing with Aho's line, because in the regular season, obviously, Kucherov wasn't around, but you know, both teams seemed very comfortable going with Point against Aho, and in the round one matchup, we saw Tampa Bay not necessarily shy away from using Point against Barkov's line, and they did fine. But I think what's going to be fascinating for me is we're going to talk about the power play here and sort of what Kucherov did there. And I know people are inclined to complain about how convenient it is that Tampa Bay activated Kucherov ahead of game one, and how he was healthy all along, and how it was this grand conspiracy. And I don't want to talk about the cap shenanigans side of it. I just want to talk about from what we saw on the ice, because I thought at 5-on-5, whether it was Kucherov adjusting to the speed of the game being thrown right into the playoffs after essentially not playing all season, or whether it's him not still being 100% from that injury and surgery he had, because the mobility wasn't typically what you see from him. He wasn't carrying the puck into the zone with the type of success we've not typically seen from him. He wasn't attacking defenders in full stride the way we've seen before. There was a number of occasions where a guy like Radko Gudas or Anton Strahlman sort of chased him down and prevented an odd man rush or an opportunity for him to be in alone versus the goalie. And that's something we wouldn't normally see when Kucherov's firing on all cylinders and he's at 5-on-5 in full strength. And so he was great on the power play. It makes sense that it would be an easier transition for him there, where he's doing a lot of his attacking from a set position on that right flank, where he's got more time and space as opposed to 5-on-5, where it's more free flowing. So I'm not sure if it's the type of situation where he's going to get more comfortable and maybe even get healthier as the series goes along, or whether this is just the way it's going to be for him for the rest of this postseason. But I had a hard time believing watching that he was fully healthy 100%. And he had been waiting for weeks and months to get back into the lineup, because he certainly didn't look that way at 5-on-5.
Yeah. And I mean, he's not the only star on that Tampa team who has that issue. Obviously Victor Hedman, you know, we've had the Norris conversations and everything like that. But I mean, the inescapable fact of the matter is that whatever he says, clearly he's not at 100%, and he hasn't been for at least half of the regular season. Like you said in your article this morning, you know, we're going to hear about whatever kind of surgery he ends up getting inevitably when they get knocked out or win the cup. But I think it's a similar situation with him, where, you know, that lack of mobility really kind of hurt them down the stretch, making a lot of uncharacteristic defensive errors, I think, on his part. And you know, all that kind of drifts away on the power play when mobility isn't really the most important thing. And it's more about making those in-zone offensive decisions, which, you know, Hedman hasn't been inhibited in that by whatever injury he's currently battling through. So I think that's an interesting point, and one that I think would benefit the Hurricanes, you know, especially because they are so good at limiting those kind of in-zone offensive chances. You know, I was looking at the numbers, you know, no team in the league allowed fewer cycle chances than the Hurricanes did this season. And, you know, if they are able to limit that counterattack, whether it's, like you said, with not having Kucherov quite as able to join the rush, and the same thing with Hedman, if he's not able to take those chances that he usually does, then the Hurricanes could put themselves in a pretty good situation in terms of just kind of possessing the Lightning to death.
Yeah, the Hedman one's fascinating to me, because clearly, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. You can pretty much neatly point to when he got hurt at the end of March against Columbus and how his numbers fell off. And Chris Johnson had reported that he's going to be having an offseason surgery. So I don't think it's necessarily any kind of secret. But at the same time, you know, you could argue that in that round one series against Florida, just because of how frequently they were attacking off the rush and how as a team they were so aggressive in terms of trying to get out to these fast break opportunities where their defensemen like Mackenzie Weegar would sprint up the ice, maybe you could argue that part of it was by design, where they wanted Hedman to stay a bit back to sort of prevent that from happening. Now, he eventually got burned by it, by I think by Ryan Lomberg in one of those overtime games where Florida won. But it's a shame, because when Hedman is at 100% and he's at his best, he's one of the best in the game at being that sort of trailer who jumps in on the rush and gives Tampa Bay another outlet there to attack. And he's so good offensively in that regard. And against Florida, I can't ever remember seeing him sort of sit back and kind of just be like, oh, you guys got this, take it from here, and I'll just sit back here and wait and see what happens and sort of pick his spots. So, yeah, if it is the injury, it's likely not going to get better as this series goes along. And certainly sort of the pace that Carolina plays at could become an issue for him. So that's definitely something to watch for.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, I mean, Florida or Carolina attacks in such a different way than Florida does. You know, fundamentally, like if you look at the breakdowns, especially of how they play in transition, you know, I mean, the Panthers, as your most recent guest, Jack Hahn, broke down in his kind of system analysis of them going into the playoffs, they really are kind of one of those, you know, you would say progressive or new age teams that really, like you said, kind of activates defensemen like Mackenzie Weegar to carry the puck into the offensive zone. They attack off the rush, they generate a crazy number of chances that way, and I think we saw that in how high flying and kind of dynamic and exciting that first round series was. The Hurricanes, on the other hand, are, you know, maybe the most, you know, dump out and dump in heavy team in the NHL. You know, they really, you know, when they're exiting their own zone, oftentimes they do it in that kind of weird way where the forwards will stick their stick out at center ice, and then Dougie Hamilton will basically take what amounts to a point shot from his own zone and just deflect it in off them. And then entering the zone, you know, it's almost always dump and chase. And that, you know, that's something that maybe could advantage the Lightning a little bit relative to not maybe having Hedman facing those kind of zooming wingers like Verhaeghe or Duclair. But, you know, at the other hand, if you're in a position like Hedman is where you are hurt like that, you know, maybe going into the corners on those puck retrievals might be a little bit extra painful. So I'm interested to see kind of how he reacts and whether, you know, maybe they play a more suited style or whether we might even see this injury be kind of aggravated even more.
This is going to be a really weird thing to say about a team like the Hurricanes, where I think they were second in the league in terms of power play efficiency. I think the Oilers were the only team that scored more frequently on a permanent basis than them with the man advantage. And they were the third best team in terms of suppressing offense on the penalty kill. And they were one of those modern sort of power kills where they're using guys like Aho and HS to attack the other team's power play and create themselves and actually score goals and use it as a weapon of theirs rather than just sitting back and trying to block shots. But I think just out of respect to this Tampa team and sort of what we saw in round one against Florida with the fact that they do now have all five top players out there in the top unit with Kucherov and Stamkos back, this isn't the type of scenario where I would be playing with fire. If I were Carolina, I would make a very concerted effort to stay out of the box. And the reason why I bring that up is because that's something that they have struggled with this season. I think they spent the fourth most time killing penalties in the regular season. In round one against Nashville, they gave them 26 power play opportunities in just six games. Rod Brind'Amour, for the second consecutive postseason, came out and publicly scrutinized the officiating and the way the Hurricanes have been reffed against. And I don't want to get into a whole thing here about playoff officiating, because it certainly has its issues, but it does make sense logically that a team like Carolina that plays at the pace they do in terms of just being kind of this aggressive swarming team that's always trying to push the envelope, it makes sense that they would eventually cross the line and come away with infractions. And so if that's going to be the case in this series, I do worry for them, because this Tampa power play looked ridiculous in the first round. They scored 8 goals in like 24 minutes on the man advantage. And basically every single time Sam Bennett or Brandon Montour made a mistake and took a dumb penalty, they made them pay instantly. And I don't see that changing, because they're just an entirely different animal when Kucherov's out there for them on the power play.
Yeah. I mean, you know, do I think that they're going to score a goal every 3 minutes of power play time they get? Yeah. Probably not. But at the same time, I wouldn't want to be putting them in that position. And I mean, like, these are two teams that are, they're both really good at both ends on special teams. Like the Hurricanes, like you said, they had the second ranked power play in the league. You know, the Lightning were ninth, but of course there's a Kucherov sized asterisk on that. And then on the penalty kill, you know, Carolina was third and Tampa Bay was fourth. So, you know, these are two teams that are potentially going to be battling to a standstill. One thing that did strike me as interesting when I was looking at Carolina's numbers was that they were actually second in expected goals against when they're on the power play. They actually give up quite a bit in terms of chances the other way. And just looking at that Tampa penalty kill lineup, you know, looking at, you know, Coleman and Gord and all these guys that they can potentially put out there, you know, I wonder whether we might see a couple instances where Tampa burns them on the counterattack on the penalty kill.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw that against Florida. I love watching that power play, because it's such a modern approach. Obviously, the personnel helps when you have two dual threats like Kucherov and Stamkos at either flank, and they can just beat you any way they want to. But, you know, with Alex Killorn, like, they're not wasting time devoting this traditional net front guy. He's like behind the net as sort of an outlet for them. If there's pressure, he can help extend possessions there. Then he's jumping in and out of the slot. You obviously have Braden Point hanging out there. And the fascinating thing to me about that 8 goals that they scored in round one, and you're right, they're, you know, we're not going to expect them to keep scoring at that rate. But the reason why I think it is sort of sustainable in the sense that they're going to score a lot of goals is because we basically saw them carve them up. They were like, okay, Florida, you can try to defend one thing, and as soon as you do that, we're going to beat you in a different way. We're going to have Kucherov passing it into Point here for an easy one-timer right from in front of the slot. We're going to have a tap-in for Alex Killorn for an empty netter. We're going to pass it over in the cross-seam pass to Stamkos, as one of the greatest shooters of his generation, for a one-timer from the left circle. Like, it's impossible to defend now. If there's one team that can do that, it is Carolina, with the sort of aggressive penalty kill they have. But I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting thing to point out in terms of what to watch for, because stylistically, it is so unique. How do we feel about the goaltending in this series? Because I think people would essentially, you know, would initially jump to the conclusion that, you know, Vasilevskiy's going to give Tampa Bay an advantage against anyone they play. But I was really impressed with Nedeljkovic, not only this regular season, but particularly in that round one matchup where he got sort of overshined by Saros in terms of the way people were talking about it online, but he was every bit as good, if not better.
Yeah. If there's one way that we could make ourselves look stupid in this podcast, it's by talking too much about goaltending, just because in my original playoff previews, I discarded my own rule of never saying anything confident about goaltending. And I think I got burned for it a little bit. But that really is the thing where you look at the Carolina Hurricanes defensively this year, and you know, the underlying numbers are okay, but they're not that great. You know, I think 17th in expected goals against, you know, 10th in unblocked shot attempts against, you know, fine, I guess, but you know, goals against is really, you know, it's kind of a Minnesota situation where you're racking your brain trying to figure out, you know, oh, like what fundamentally changed about this team that turned them into a, you know, real contender. And the answer is pretty much they got some of the best goaltending in the NHL, and they got it from an unconventional source, you know, from a guy who was put on waivers at the beginning of the season and now finds himself as the starter in round two. And that does always make you a little bit nervous, and I think for good reason. And I think there's every reason to say that the Lightning have the advantage in this area. But you know, this isn't the situation that Carolina has been in the past, where they're just kind of plugging a hole in the net. Like, they have a guy who has performed very well for them this season. So it wouldn't completely shock me if he just continues that run, and we're looking at Cam Ward 2.0. But at the same time, there's every chance as well that the bottom might fall out on this thing, and Tampa might be preying on him on those counterattacks.
Oh yeah, particularly with the talent level, or the you know, quality of competition increase that going from Nashville to Tampa Bay here. But you know, 932 save percentage in regular season, 922 in this postseason so far. And I thought in particular, you know, in games 3 and 4, the shots were ridiculous in Carolina's favor, where Saros made 50 plus saves in each of them, and myself included. It was very impressive in terms of just the volume of work that he was facing and sort of the types of saves he was making. But then you look, and Nashville in those two games actually had more high danger attempts in both of those games. Yeah. Compared to Carolina. And you know, part of that was Slavin not being out there, and they were relying a lot on defensemen who probably they shouldn't have. But they weren't necessarily super stingy or completely dominating. They were in terms of all in the quantity, but not the quality. And Niljkovic was really good. And so I just wanted to give him a little bit of love here, because I think once again, just with the star power of Vasilevskiy, he's going to be overshadowed, but he will give them a chance here. Now, at the same time, we were worried a bit about Vasilevskiy's sort of final month of the season or so, and whether he had been fatigued because they'd overworked him at the start of the year. And he put all of those concerns to rest with, I thought, a fantastic performance against the Panthers. Yeah. Florida had 227 shots, 79 high danger attempts in those six games. And he finished with a 928 save percentage, plus 4 goals saved, then emphatic shutout in the clincher. And he was every bit as good as the guy who's going to win the Vezina this year or finish second or whatever he does. But he, yeah, if he's going to be playing at that level, it opens up so much for Tampa Bay, because they can comfortably sort of just not worry about what, you know, limiting the chances or what's going to happen defensively, because they know that he's going to stop it. And then as soon as they get the puck, they can go on those counterattacks that you were talking about.
Yeah. And I think we're going to see some very high save percentages in this series, just kind of looking at the way these two teams play. You know, the top two teams in the league in terms of the percentage of their 5-on-5 shots that were taken by defensemen, number one was Tampa Bay and number two was Carolina. Like, there's going to be a lot of, you know, dump and chase, forecheck, and then get that puck low to high and then throw it on the net. And I think in large part, that's one of the big reasons that we saw UC Saros kind of put up those 50 save games, was because that was the game plan for Carolina. And, you know, Tampa Bay, when that point Kucherov line is off the ice, that's basically the way they play as well. So I know that, you know, for me personally, when I'm watching a team that I'm cheering for, all those point shots are the heart attack shots, because you can just envision every single one of them, you know, taking a wild deflection, ending up in the net. I feel like Tampa Bay and Carolina fans are going to be in for a, you know, a full 7-game series of those heart attacks, because that is really the way these teams like to get pucks on the goal.
Awesome. Playoff hockey. You got to love it. Is there anything else in this series that we should highlight or talk about? I feel like we've kind of covered most of the big talking points.
Yeah. Who do you, I don't know if you're in the market of making kind of predictions or telling me kind of where you're leaning towards, but what's kind of the sense that you get looking at these two teams matching up?
Well, I think, you know, Carolina's a game in terms of, especially if they can keep this at 5-on-5, I think they can definitely hang. I haven't seen anything from the regular season or the postseason that would suggest otherwise. You kind of have to throw all the numbers out the window, though, now that the Kucherov is back for Tampa Bay, just because they're such an entirely different attacking team. And I'm at the point with them where I think they're imperfect. I think especially with the health concerns that we've laid out, they're not necessarily as dominant as they could be otherwise, but I'd be very reluctant and worried to bet against that talent, just because you could easily see Carolina outshoot them and even outplay them for large stretches, similar to what Florida did. And at the end of the day, they're going to score power play goals. Vasilevsky's going to be the better goalie and Tampa Bay is going to win just because they have the best players at the most high leverage positions.
Yeah. See, like I have to admit that I'm leaning pretty decisively towards Tampa, looking at everything. And I think that the X factor for me is just the way that, you know, if there was ever a team where their 5-on-5 offense could validly be criticized on the basis of expected by whom exactly, it would be the Carolina Hurricanes. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of smoke around this team in terms of the public models overrating their scoring chances. You know, just the way that they kind of do the point shot and rebound thing. You know, this has been going on for 5 years now. You know, by the public numbers that I have in front of me, you know, they were fourth in expected goals, 19th in goals for, and last in the league in goals above expected. You know, that I think tells me a little bit about what the quality of their chances is actually looking like. And if that is indeed the case, then I feel like Tampa could have a pretty decisive edge on them in 5-on-5 offense. But, you know, like we said, for all we know, Alex Nedeljkovic is going to go Cam Ward mode, and we're going to be looking pretty silly saying that a week from now.
Yeah, no, it is true. At the same time, I'd be worried about going fully in that direction just because Carolina is a good team. Like, they have very few weak links, and they can play at sort of a tempo in terms of just speed bagging teams at times. And if Tampa Bay isn't getting the saves for whatever reason, like, it could easily go the other way. But yeah, I'm kind of on the fence. I'm excited to watch it. Yeah. I would lean towards Tampa Bay, but I think it'll be a tight one. Speaking of teams who the expected goals, expected according to whom, let's talk about the Vegas Golden Knights here.
I was trying to figure out whether you're going Vegas or Montreal, so I'm glad that you went Vegas.
Let's quickly do the Colorado-Vegas round two matchup, because, you know, they're right there in terms of entertainment value with the one we just talked about. Now, as you alluded to, I did a full deep dive on the AV system with Jack Hahn in the most recent episode of the PDO cast, and people should just go check that out because we essentially talked about them for like 45 minutes. And so I don't want to regurgitate a lot of that stuff. Instead, I'd rather kind of focus on the Vegas angle here, especially since we just recently saw them squeak by the Minnesota Wild in game 7 last night. And I've got some stats for you, and I know that you've been monitoring this as well. So over the last 4 playoff series for the Knights, round 1 last year against Corey Crawford, he scored 15 goals on 17.5 expected goals. Corey Crawford had a 920 save percentage. In round 2 against the Canucks, they scored 19 times on 27 expected goals. And particularly with Thatcher Demko, when he took over for the final 3 games, they scored just 2 times total on 125 shots. Round 3 against Anton Hudobin, they scored 8 goals, had 15 expected goals. Anton Hudobin had a 950 save percentage. And in this series against Cam Talbot, it was a bit better. They scored 20 goals, only 21.4 expected goals. So fairly close. Now, that's after a 5-goal outburst in game 7. And Cam Talbot still had a 923 save percentage for the series with 2 shutouts. We can even loop the 2018-19 series against the Sharks in round 1, where they had a performance against Martin Jones where he stopped 58 of 59 shots against them. Like, we're reaching the territory, I think, with them. And I don't necessarily know how to evaluate it, where it's one thing to be unlucky and just run into a hot goalie, or, you know, just have an unfortunate series or even an unfortunate playoff run. But this is a number of goalies now where they have had these performances that they pile up the shots, and for whatever reason, even though they do have talent, I think they're not converting on them. And I'm not really sure what to make of it. How do we evaluate, and how do we sort of frame what's going on with Vegas in these playoff series in terms of the volume they're generating and what they actually have to show for it?
Yeah, it's a really tough one. I had somebody tell me that I should Vegas adjust Cam Talbot's numbers at the end of the series just to make them fairly assessed. But yeah, I mean, you know, like you said, like if Vegas and Carolina meet in the Stanley Cup Finals, it might set an NHL record for most shots taken in a series, because like they really have that kind of very similar approach in terms of, you know, just generating so much volume and. You know, especially I think they defer to it in particular in the playoffs, where you know, they I guess determined that they want to play a very kind of playoff style of hockey, and it, in their minds that means kind of relying more heavily on the in zone offensive stuff. And you know, you get a lot of shots from low danger areas that turn into kind of scrambles and rebounds and stuff from more high danger areas, and for whatever reason, you know, whether you want to kind of go the goaltending psychology aspect where they're letting goalies kind of stop a lot of pucks and get into rhythms and things like that. You know, I'm not, so I couldn't really speak to that as much, but it's really hard to argue with the results when, you know, they're piled up over such a long span. And I mean, we did see less of the expected by whom stuff going on for them in the regular season. And like you said, kind of in this series, it wasn't necessarily as pronounced in terms of the above expected numbers. But, you know, I think there is definitely a pattern emerging here. And when you have a team like Colorado that not only, you know, does similar things in terms of quantity, but also matches it in terms of just the sheer amount of quality scoring chances that they're able to generate, you know, without flinching, it's a tough matchup. I mean, I feel like kind of betting against the Avalanche in a series is kind of like betting against like the 2008 Red Wings. Like that's like the level of dominant that we're talking about here. And Vegas is as good a match as you could really hope to put against them, you know, not only in this division, but I think a lot of people are thinking of this as being basically, you know, the Western Conference Final or the Stanley Cup Final in any other year. And I'm excited to see it, but it wouldn't surprise me at all to see Philip Grubauer put up like a 940 and for Colorado just to dispatch these guys a little more quickly than, you know, we might have expected previously.
It's so weird because for the most part, if you look at especially the top players for Vegas, it's not like they're a team filled with these guys that are, you know, routinely like this is a weird niche throwback, but like the Michael Frolik when he was on Calgary, where it's like he's playing with Backlund Kachuk and he's just posting these 7% and 8% shooting percentage seasons year in and year out, despite the opportunities he's getting. Like they have above average finishers and shooters, and the figure the talent would be there where this wouldn't be an issue. But I do wonder how much of it is coaching in terms of sort of the playing style and maybe changing their approach because they feel like they need to be more conservative and not opening it up. And that's going to be an issue in this series because, as you alluded to, if there's one team you don't want to do that against, it's this Colorado team that essentially doesn't really give anything up, doesn't spend time in the defensive zone, and has a really good goalie in Philip Grubauer who just doesn't give up goals against. And so it could lead to some comical numbers. Now, at the same time, this Vegas team does match up, I think, as well as you can hope against this Colorado team, because they can match them in speed, they can match them in physicality and size, and you know, whether they're spamming shots or not, they're a good possession team and they're not going to get bowled over, I don't think. And that's one of my questions for this is we've seen Colorado essentially all the way through the regular season and through round one against St. Louis just post these comical 60%+ shot rates and chance rates and everything across the board at 5-on-5. And what's that going to look like in a 7-game series against Vegas, where it seems hard to imagine that it would be as divided as it's been so far for Colorado?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I remember after that series against the Canucks and then also Dallas last year, you know, that was something that I looked into. You know, I wrote a bit about it, and you know, I basically came up with like 5 different possible explanations, and it was really impossible to rule any of them out just because they were all plausible. And you know, one kind of fringe one that I remember hearing from a former player that I asked about it was he was very critical of the stick curves of the top Vegas players. He said that they were not suited to elevating pucks in tight off rebounds. So speaking of somebody who always just went with the stick curve that came on the stick that I bought on sale from SportCheck, I'd have to defer to him on that one. But yeah, you know, like you'd think there has to be some kind of explanation for what's going on here. And I think that that's as good a good of one as any. But, you know, it really is hard to imagine Vegas getting outshot and outchanced by massive margins just because we really haven't seen it that much. You know, I mean, even in that series against Minnesota, they only really had one game where they got fully outplayed to that extent. And that was game two. The inverse is true. You know, if any team was going to do it against Vegas, it would be the Avalanche. But I think, like you said, there's some areas of that matchup, especially in terms of physicality. And, you know, man, wouldn't the hockey men love it if Alex Tuch and them really just forecheck the hell out of Colorado's tiny defensemen and ground them into dust that way. But it's the series that I'm most excited for sure. And the one that I think has the most potential to have some real kind of offensive fireworks to it. So I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah. And the one X factor here is that, you know, through the regular season, I'm not sure for how many of these minutes Colorado actually had the full repertoire, because there was time where a bunch of the players were out of action in these games, but Stone and McKinnon went head to head for 43 minutes at 5-on-5 this season. And Stone pretty much played McKinnon's line to a draw. The goals were 2-2. They slightly outshot them, slightly outchanced them. And, you know, Colorado has the talent, especially with that line, where they don't need to have 60% of the shots to still come out ahead because the talent is so high. But it's one of the few lines in the league, I think, that could reliably go head to head against McKinnon, Rantanen, and Landeskog and not get completely embarrassed and just pinned in their own zone for extended periods of time. And so that's quite a luxury for Pete DeBoer in Vegas to have, to sort of, you know, they might limit their own offense if they go fully hard matching that, but it might be one of the only sort of paths to limiting what that Colorado top line can do offensively.
For sure. Well, thank God Colorado's second line center didn't get himself suspended for most of, if not the entire series, because, you know, that
would be a shame if that had happened.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is there anything else from Colorado Vegas that you wanted to talk about? I kind of already have done all of my my Av stuff, so I think I'm good in that regard. But I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, I think you covered it pretty well with Jack there.
Cool. All right, let's do Islanders Bruins, a series that you just recently put up a full preview for on EP Ringside that I recommend people go check out. What are we looking for in this series? Because you were talking about the offensive fireworks. I think we're all expecting that, you know, you could argue these are the two best defensive teams and sort of the traditional sense of just, you know, shutting things down and not letting the other team generate a ton of good looks. So you'd think that with the goaltending and the defensive structures, it would lend itself to your classic kind of grinded out 2-1, maybe 3-2 in like a triple overtime type of setting. But should we be expecting that? Like how are we, what are we sort of sizing up in this series in terms of the matchups or the storylines to look for?
Yeah. So like you said, kind of on its surface, this really does profile as like the classic, like every single game in the series is going to be 2-1 or 3-2 or what have you. The X factor for me is the Bruins offense, because that has been the thing that has really lifted them to the next level since that trade deadline. You know, going into the deadline, they were, you know, one of, if not, you know, the worst offensive team in the league that was anywhere near a playoff spot. And then if you look at their numbers since the deadline, they've been one of the best offensive teams in the league. And I think you can draw a pretty straight line with the guys they acquired. But also, you know, Marchand, Pasternak and Bergeron have just reached a totally, you know, new level in terms of, you know, not only their scoring chances, but they're also scoring at 5-on-5 and on the power play. And, you know, that's the real thing for me of whether we're going to see kind of a grind 'em out series or whether the Bruins offense can break through. You know, we know what to expect from that top line, but you know, if Krejci and Taylor Hall and Craig Smith can really get things going from, you know, there against the Islanders, that would be a pretty massive breakthrough. And I think could be fairly decisive in, you know, dismantling what the Islanders have been able to do defensively.
Yeah, well, especially since I imagine similar to what we saw in round one, where Pelech and Pulock were, they were trying as hard as they could to get them out against Crosby's line. And, you know, they got hammered in shots, but they kept the goals pretty even. And I think they'll take that anytime they can. I imagine we're going to see a lot of Hall, Smith and Krejci against that Mayfield and Letty pair. And I think we saw from them that, you know, they can be exposed in terms of the forecheck. And hey, we saw the Penguins cause a bunch of turnovers and give them trouble exiting their own zone when they were out there. And so if that line can really get the puck in and sort of cycle and forecheck and have extended shifts and allow the top line to come out in more advantageous situations potentially and not be so easily hard matched against, that that's an interesting wrinkle to this, because as you've been highlighting ever since this said the trade, I think we were both big time believers in the regard of Taylor Hall is still good and he was misused and he's going to do very well in this new environment. In the regular season, that line in 180 minutes, the shots were 121 to 60 for them and the high danger attempts were 41 to 20. And I think it was fair to wonder how much of that was playing a ton against Buffalo and New Jersey and how it would look against better competition. And in round one against Washington in 62 minutes, the shots were 35-25 with them on the ice and the high danger attempts were 18-7. And so they carried over that success. And if they can do so again, it could be a real leg up for Boston, because we know over the years it's been, all right, well, if you shut down that top line or play them to as much of a draw as you can, you're going to be okay. And if this second line can get out there and keep the ice tilted in that regard, then it's going to be a long series for the Islanders.
Yeah, I think there's kind of no winning for the Islanders defensively when it comes to matching up against the Krejci and Hall line, just because one of the Islanders' biggest strengths, especially kind of when they get their stuff together in the playoffs, is defending against the rush, because they are so kind of strong defending that blue line. Like, they just stack guys there. They force you to either just skate into a defenseman and give up a counterattack chance, or you just have to dump it in, recover it. And, a lot of the time that's a 50-50 battle at best. But with especially that kind of Krejci, Hall, Smith line, that line is so good at both of those things. You know, we've seen their rush game totally open up since the trade deadline, just because obviously we know that Hall can enter the zone with speed and attack off the rush, and he's done that. You know, I think he had like the fifth most rush attempts after the trade deadline in his time with the Bruins. But we saw it from Krejci as well, where he's not a guy that we kind of envision as being, you know, particularly speedy. But having Hall on that unit with him really opened up the ways that they were able to attack. So they're able to do that, and we might be able to see them break things up with the Islanders by entering the zone of speed. But if they can't, they're just as good at forechecking. You know, Craig Smith, obviously, we know what he can do. We know that that's kind of his entire game is using his skating to get to areas and retrieve pucks and get them to people or get them on net. And Taylor Hall, you know, his most underrated skill set is puck retrieval. You know, he is a really great forechecker, and that's one of the big reasons why people who were kind of, you know, criticizing his game as not being playoff ready based on just kind of superficial things and probably a lot of it just him being unfortunate enough to play for some bad teams. You know, he plays a style that I think could actually be very successful against the Islanders if he really gets into that forechecking mode. So I'm really interested to see, you know, like you said, they're going to be out there against Leddy and Mayfield. That's a matchup that they really should win. So that could be kind of a big X factor for the Bruins. If they can get that second line going, then I have a hard time seeing them losing the series, you know, save for Jari level goaltending nightmares.
Well, you know, from the Islanders' perspective here, I guess the craziest stat is, now that you mention it, Jared having, what, -8 goals saved or something in the 6 games. But, you know, from the more, like, just viewing it from the prism of the Islanders and sort of the fact that they got through that series, considering that they got 0 goals, 3 assists, and only 1 5-on-5 point from Barzal in those 6 games is pretty remarkable. Now, he did have some spirited rushes, and I think he will eventually break through if he keeps playing the way he has, because he's so dangerous. But it's remarkable. You'd think that he would have had an explosive offensive series, especially with what Jari was giving up, and that wasn't the case. And the other stat that I noticed was, you know, the Islanders trailed for nearly 60% of that series. I think they led for only 65 or so minutes through those 6 games, and they're a team that's designed to get an early lead, keep getting the puck deep, just forecheck the crap out of it, just break everything down in the neutral zone, not allow you to come in with any sort of a rush, and just really grind the game out and punish you for any mistakes you make by coming back on the counterattack and scoring off the rush. And so the fact that they came through that series and won it 4-2, despite the fact that they weren't really able to play that way at all and didn't get anything of note from their top offensive player, is pretty remarkable to me. And so, we'll see what happens in this series, but at least like you would think that Barzal would be due for a little bit more offense considering how talented he is.
Yeah, and I guess it would be karma for the Bruins to get lit up by Barzal. So
no one will tweet about that. I'm sure there will be no jokes of the such.
Definitely not.
The other thing that I did want to note was, I think especially in that Penguins Islanders series, it was fair to say that the Islanders were going to have the goaltending advantage because of the personnel. I think most people would have thought it would have been the goalie that was fifth in goal saved and second in save percentage in the regular season. But Varlamov was banged up and then he struggled and Sorokin basically took the crease from him and didn't give it back. And it's rare to say about a goalie because their whole job is to prevent fun essentially. But Sorokin is one of the few goalies that's legitimately fun to watch. Annette, maybe not for you as a Penguins fan, but just his ability in terms of the athleticism, in terms of his ability to kick out the pad in just remarkable time and make these wild saves. I'd been waiting years for him to come to the NHL, and I was really curious to see how he'd play in the system. And they really eased him in this season. He struggled right out of the gate with rebound control and whatnot, but really rounded into form here. And he is an X factor in this series. I know we don't want to talk too much about goaltending because it's so unpredictable, but it feels like considering how talented he is and considering that he's playing for a Barry Trotz team with Mitch Gordon as his goalie coach, if there was one thing we could say that was predictable about a goalie, it would be that he could be really, really good in this series again.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely looking forward to enjoying watching him play for the first time in this series.
All right. Is there anything else in this matchup that we wanted to highlight or talk about? Like, I feel like for the most part, people are generally pretty aware of the way these two teams play and sort of what to expect from them. And so I don't think there's anything too much more for us to highlight in terms of like, ooh, you should actually check this out because it's different than what you might think.
Yeah, I think really the only really big surprise, you know, like you said, was the way that the offense had opened up since the deadline. And I think that we covered that pretty comprehensively. So it'll definitely be an interesting series to watch, especially I think that it has the potential to be an actually exciting low scoring series. So, you know, and again, I'm looking forward to being able to enjoy what this Islanders team can do without watching the game through my fingers for the first time. So it'll be interesting.
Well, and that's the thing. I do feel like the Islanders get an unfair shake, I think, because you look at sometimes at the suppression numbers and you look at, you know, the shot totals, for example, and you're like, oh, that was boring. But especially in front of that home crowd, which is pretty wild, there are sequences and there are moments where, you know, when they're creating off of those counterattack opportunities, they're a surprisingly good rush team. And you know, when they get desperate, they're like sending all three forwards like below the hash marks on the forecheck and just trying really, really hard to get the puck back. And that sort of that type of aggression like is fun for me to watch. Maybe I'm a huge hockey nerd and the general casual fan doesn't find that particularly exciting, but I do think there is a sense of urgency that they play with that is legitimately, you know, a positive in terms of the viewing experience. And they're not nearly as boring as people might lead you to believe.
Yeah. That rush thing is definitely a good observation. That really is kind of a focal point of how they generate offense. And I think that surprises a lot of people. You know, it certainly was a huge factor in that Penguins series where so many of their chances were coming off counterattacks just because the Penguins had the puck in their end and were generating shots for so much of it. And then you turn around and it seemed like they had a 3-on-2 or, you know, a 3-on-3 with momentum pretty frequently. And, you know, a lot of the time they don't necessarily have the skill to do that much with it. Obviously, you know, they ran into a goalie where they could basically take shots from the hash marks and it was a 50-50 chance to go in. But I think that's definitely an interesting point. And the Bruins have been a little bit weak defending the rush this year. So that could definitely be a factor in the series that could make things more exciting for the Islanders and actually maybe tilt the scales in their favor if they do end up kind of getting outpossessed, like I think it's fair to expect that they might.
Mm. All right, man. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I think all three of these are going to be very exciting and very close. And we're not going to talk about the North one because we are recording this on a Saturday morning and we still don't know who the Jets will be playing. You know, the Leafs and Habs play their game 6 tonight. And so instead, what I'm going to do is we're just going to cap it at these three, and then I'm going to do a full series, a full episode about the North Division round two matchup once it gets started next week. So I promise the listeners we'll get to it eventually, although I'm sure there is no shortage of Leafs coverage elsewhere that you can get. So they're not too starved for it, but this was a blast, man. I'm glad we got to do this. Do you want to plug some stuff? Where can people check you out, both on Twitter and in terms of your work and all that good stuff?
Yeah. So obviously the main place that I'm writing right now is Elite Prospects, which I would imagine that a lot of your listeners are probably already subscribed to, but if they're not, I would hope so, but I definitely recommend that they check it out. You can find me on Twitter at JFreshHockey. You can find all of my data visualizations and stuff available on my Patreon under the same name. And I still occasionally will write some stuff on my Substack account, which is also under the name jfresh.substack.com. So if you like what you hear, definitely make sure to check that out.
All right, man. Well, this is a blast. I'm glad we got to do this. It was good to finally have you officially on the show. We had recorded a show earlier this season, and because of audio difficulties, we weren't able to run it. So it was good to finally do this. Keep up the good work. I've been enjoying working with you at EP Ringside. And everyone, please enjoy the round two of the playoffs. It's going to be awesome. And we'll be back with another show here soon. So we'll have you back on, man. But until then, take care, and I enjoy the playoffs.
Great. You too.
Follow on Twitter at Dim Filipovich and on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/hockeypediocast.